On this week's 51%, we examine water, first as a metaphor, as Shapeshifter explains.
Shapeshifting to me is allowing water to be our greatest teacher.
Then, through the narrative of a Tucson teenager. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Open my door, wide open my door, open my door.
Are you ready to shift?
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is back with her 51% segment, Force of Nature. This time, she interviews Shapeshifter, formerly known as Zakiya Harris. Shapeshifter is a cultural architect working at the intersections of personal transformation, art, and education. As an entrepreneur by day, Shapeshifter is a visionary figure helping to advance opportunities for the Black community's under-resourced youth in Oakland, California. By night, Shapeshifter brings audiences her fusion of hip-hop vocals and electronic beats. Her latest single is Open My Door. Ufberg begins by asking Shapeshifter, spelled with a number 8 instead of an A, to share her story.
Well, I'm an Oakland native, and I did what many people of my generation were taught to do in life, which is to check off all the to-do boxes of going to college, getting a good job, getting married, buying a house, having a child, building that whole nuclear family paradigm that many of us are told to do. And I did all of those things and was actually very successful in all of those things. However, I felt miserable. I felt like there was this other person that wanted to emerge, and she was bold and vibrant and creative. I felt like I was living a compartmentalized life. I was showing up as one person at work. I had this creativity in my music that I wanted to nurture, and that was this other person. I had this spiritual aspect of the practices that kept me grounded, and that was another person. And I really wanted to integrate all of those pieces. And in the blank of an eye, my whole kind of world turned upside down about 10 years ago. The nonprofit that I was running at the time lost all of its funding. I had to lay off all of my staff. The home that I had sunk my entire life savings into with my husband got foreclosed on. My husband and at the time and I divorced. At the tail end of it, I got into a bicycling accident and had this big scar on the middle of my face that I've had to walk with. And it just felt like every single part of my identity, being a homeowner, being a business owner, being a wife, was stripped away from me. And it really forced me to do some serious soul searching and recognize, like, who are you beyond the labels? Who was I beyond all of those labels? And that's where this mantra of shapeshifting really came to me. Shapeshifting to me is allowing water to be our greatest teacher. As we know, water makes up the majority of our planet. Water makes up the majority of our bodies. Water is feminine in nature. Water is always taking the shape of any vessel that you put it into. It takes the shape of a vessel. If you pour it on the floor, it takes the shape of the floor. Water is always finding its own momentum. And even though water might feel passive, we also know that the power of water can be very powerful. And so I had to learn how to shift. I had to learn how to hold on to something and to keep flowing and to keep finding my own momentum while as I rebuilt my life literally from the ground up. And during that whole period, I went into my closet and I had built a makeshift studio. And I just created my first solo EP. Actually, my husband and I were doing music together at the time. So this was my first time kind of reaching out into my own creative practice as a independent artist. And that is where I created my first songs about shapeshifting, She's a Shapeshifter, Becoming a Shapeshifter, and a series of kind of amazing events that happened along the way allowed me to end up co-founding several other startups, becoming a successful business consultant, and now author and coach. So I'm able to look back on that whole experience now and recognize it as a gift, even though it felt pretty terrifying at the time.
Wow, you really have transformed yourself, and I think it's a testament to your resilience and to your, you know, desire to keep growing. I love the water analogy. You know, the music obviously is very important to you and your entrepreneurial work. I'm wondering, in the midst of all of these other responsibilities and interests, what compelled you to write your book? You wrote this book, Shapeshift Your Life, The Creative Entrepreneur's Guide to Self-Love, Self-Mastery, and Fearless Self-Expression. How did you have a moment to sit down and write that?
Well, you know, people kind of, a lot of folks in my community watched my journey and they knew me as a married woman and saw me after and saw me through the whole piece. I think one thing was being vulnerable with what was real. I think sometimes we have a tendency to hide our pain, to hide those parts of us, those challenging times, and to put on that face. And I never did that. I was very transparent with my community and those around me about what was going on. And so they were able to witness my transformation. And so a lot of them asked me, hey, how did you do this? How have you been able to navigate being an artist, being an entrepreneur, being a mother? It doesn't feel like you're compromising any of your authenticity. And so I decided to just create a super simple read, because I feel like a lot of folks don't like reading these days. So a really short kind of handbook around what are the tools and practices that kept me grounded along the way, that allowed me to transform, allowed me to build resilience. It didn't just come by luck. It wasn't willy-nilly. It was intentional work that I had to do along the way and hold on to something beyond these externalities that we're leaving. And so that book turned into a workshop. It turned into me being able to do women-led retreats. I'm doing wellness pop-ups now, and really just kind of pivoted my world into kind of focusing on the internal. I think there's so much competition and drive for people to achieve. But I think we are now starting to question at what cost. And so now my work is really supporting people in shape-shifting their own lives.
And just on top of all of that incredibly interesting and very productive work, you're going on tour with your latest music soon, right?
So I like, am, yeah.
How are you melding all of these interests and passions together with this tour?
I think that's a great question. Well, I think the first thing is I wrote my book as titled as The Creative Entrepreneur, because I think all of us are creative, whether or not you self-identify as a quote-unquote artist or not. We're creating projects, we're creating ideas, we're creating mindsets. So I really want everyone to lean into the idea that we're all creative, and our creativity actually nurtures every single part of us. Like, I was nurturing my creativity in my closet while I was going through my own transformation. And so I've really worked over the last couple of years to kind of bring those worlds, my creative world, again, kind of stopping the compartmentalization along with my healing practice and my own spiritual journey. And so this music, the EP is entitled After Darkness, and it really represents me coming out of this dark period. And a dark period, like seeds bloom out of the dark, not like this dark doom and gloom period, but a period that I needed to go through so I could branch out. And all of us are going to have to bring all of our gifts to the world now. Like, we look at the problems that our country's facing. There's so many to name. Our world is facing. And so now this is the time for us not to compartmentalize, for us to bring it all forward and know that we hold the solutions that the world needs.
It's very visionary of you, and I think very helpful for women who are looking for ways to pivot and to figure out how to bring together the different components of the things they love and things they care about. So tell me, before I let you go, what's next for Shapeshifter? What are your next dreams? You're as a creative woman, a musician, entrepreneur, teacher, mother, friend, what do you see in your future?
That's a great question. I think pushing myself out of my comfort zone even more, putting myself in more uncomfortable positions, mentally, spiritually, physically, and career-wise, because I know that's where growth happens. And, you know, my kind of person I look up to is Oprah. You know, I'm coming for her. I want to be a huge media mogul. I want to be on bigger stages, bigger platforms, sharing my work with larger and larger audiences, because I think that many of us, but I'm definitely, like many of us, holding the medicine that the world needs right now. So what's next for me is moving on up.
Fantastic. Shapeshifter, thanks so much for being with us today. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Shapeshifter's Instagram handle is She's a Shapeshifter, and you can find more information at shapeshifter.com. Again, that's spelled SH8, P.E. Shifter. Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. 17-year-old Paloma Martinez lives in Tucson, Arizona. She hears a global water crisis might be coming, and her mom thinks Tucson is going to become a ghost town soon. Martinez is with youth radio group City High Radio from City High School in Tucson. Martinez turns to some experts to find out just how worried she should be.
I live in Tucson, where summers are beginning to reach 118 degrees and the saguaro cacti are 45 feet tall. You'd never imagine that there used to be a river that flowed right through the middle of town. There were watermelons growing on the banks, and people used to have boat parties and picnics under gigantic trees, but the river is dry now. I live less than a block from the Santa Cruz River Wash. All it is now is miles and miles of sand and trash. I hear there might be a global water crisis coming soon, and I hear about cities like Cape Town running out of water, and I look at my city, and I feel afraid. My mom is worried too.
You know, being a homeowner and stuff, it makes me consider if I want to even live here or if I should sell it now before, you know, the word gets out that there's going to be no water left and then everyone abandons. Like, I envision this ghost town.
My teachers are also worried. Do you ever worry about Tucson running out of water?
Yes, all the time.
Yeah, I guess.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh my God, I worry about Tucson running out of water every single day.
I wanted to know if we were right to be so worried about water security, so I hunted down some experts.
My name is Sharon Megdell. I'm director of the Water Resources Research Center at the University of Arizona, and I do not see Tucson running out of water in the near future.
And then I asked a cultural ecologist.
My name is Joaquin Murrieta Saldívar. Do we have a water crisis? Not really.
Just to be sure, I asked a superintendent at Tucson Water.
I'm James McAdam.
Can you see Tucson running out of water for any reason in the near future?
No.
It doesn't keep you up at night ever?
No, it really doesn't.
Okay, so if there's no crisis, why is our river dry?
I think the simplest reason why it stopped flowing is that too much water was pumped out of the ground.
And so rivers are connected to the ground below it?
They explained to me that Tucson is built on a giant aquifer, which is like a big underground reservoir of water. We dug wells and pumped up the water, and as the population grew, they had to dig deeper and deeper.
But if you start pumping that groundwater and you pump it a lot, then that tends to take the water from under the river and the river doesn't flow anymore.
Okay, so I get why the river's not running, but why aren't they worried about running out of water?
About 80% of the water that we serve to customers is Colorado River water.
I'm embarrassed to admit that I had no idea that since the early 90s, the Central Arizona Project, also known as CAP, has been our main source of water.
It's a concrete canal. It's probably the width of, like, I don't know, two or three lanes of traffic.
We divert water from the river and it travels through the desert for 336 miles to Tucson, uphill.
We're about 3,000 feet higher than Lake Havasu, where the water comes in. And so to get it here, you have to lift it. And so they have this series of big pumping stations.
40% of the electricity we use in Arizona is to move water. Just to move water. So I'm opening the tap in my house. That water is full of energy.
And where does that energy come from?
Historically, the Central Arizona Project was relying on power from the Navajo Generating Station. That is a coal-fired plant.
Okay, so we get this Colorado River water that uses a ton of energy, but does that really make us secure? Do you think that it makes some people feel insecure that we get our water from so far away?
Yeah, I think it does. I think people feel this, you know, a visceral kind of insecurity, like, you know, something could happen on the Colorado River and then what'll we do? But that Colorado River water also buys us a lot of flexibility because our customers use about 90,000 acre feet a year and we get about 144,000 acre feet.
So we get more water than we need and all the extra, we sink it into the ground and it's kind of like a savings account of water. And the aquifer is actually rising again under Tucson.
We are really in a really, really, really good position, especially compared to a lot of other cities in the West and in the East. Because, you know, if the CAP were to shut off today, we could pump groundwater for decades and survive without doing anything.
Dang. That is pretty reassuring, but I don't understand. If our population is growing, how do we have all this extra water we can afford to bank?
Since the mid-80s, we've added 200,000 people to our service area, and we're using the same amount of potable water.
Wait. How is that possible?
A huge amount of that is we use less water per person. You know, our water use has leveled off and is declining, as even though our numbers and our economy is bigger.
He explained to me that we use a lot of reclaimed water, and he said that Tucson has a culture of conservation. We've taken out a lot of our lawns and planted more native trees.
10 years ago, each of us Tucsonians were using 95 gallons per person a day. Now, we're using 80 gallons per person a day. So we are diminishing our water needs. In my home, I'm at 56 gallons.
How do you do that?
How do we? Of course, I don't take a shower. No, we do. I have an outdoor shower, and I can take a shower outside. Nobody sees me. And that water goes into my plants.
You know, sort of how you judge, how you compare to other cities is gallons per capita per day. And by that measure, we are, you know, national leaders.
So if we are national leaders, does that mean I can stop feeling guilty about taking a shower?
People don't have to worry about the utility running out of water and not having water to provide them. But I never said you don't need to be a good water steward, right? You need to be conscientious and conscious of the water you use and be a good steward. And that means you don't waste it. And I think of that sometimes in my own home. When my husband does the dishes, and it's like, you've got that water on too strong. You don't need such a pressure. It's wasting water.
I don't think you should worry about it. I think you should enjoy it and appreciate it more than worry about it. I think what I would wish I could do for everyone is for them to see what is involved in getting their water to them. From an environmental standpoint, first of all, we have to take it from the Colorado River. And we are part of a system that has depleted this whole delta area of the Colorado River going into the Gulf of California that was one of the largest wetlands in the world and is now sort of a remnant of its former self. And then even just what is involved in the water coming in at Lake Havasu, being pumped uphill, if you knew what was involved in getting the water to your house, you don't have to think about like, oh, I should turn my water off when I'm brushing my teeth. You just do because you know.
It was shocking to me when I learned that the Colorado River doesn't reach the sea anymore. And I had no idea that the river's delta in Mexico had dried up. It was a huge ecosystem, and now all of these plants and animals have died, all because of us. Do you think we need to worry about that stuff more here? Do you think water conservation and appreciation is for everybody?
Oh, it's definitely for everybody. Because just having water around does not mean you have water to drink and to live off of. You know, look at Flint, Michigan. Look at, everywhere.
Crisis can be inadequate water, impure, unclean water. It can also mean too much water. Flooding, failure of dams, things like that.
Did scientists 50 years ago worry about water, and is that why we are okay today? Is it our worry about the water now that is going to make us okay for the future?
Yes and yes. If we all used the same amount of water now per person that we did in the 80s, we wouldn't be banking any water. We wouldn't have any flexibility. We would just be all maxed out, and we would be in a water crisis. And if we want to stay here, yes, we are going to need to continue to plan and invest and spend money now on things that won't yield results for decades.
He brought up a point I hadn't thought about.
I think if we have good government and professional planning. Like, a lot of people like to bag on planning, like, oh, it's just sort of this wonky thing. Well, planning is the difference between us and Cape Town. And that is what is the difference between a crisis and not. The real risk is socio-political. It's not resource. And that is what keeps me up at night.
They seem so sure. Like, we've got all this water, and they know it's not without a cost, and we should keep trying to conserve, but I couldn't help but feeling a little bit nervous. Couldn't climate change change everything? What about climate change? Does that keep you up at night?
Yeah. Yeah, I think because it's so unpredictable. Things hit tipping points, and then they change really dramatically, really quickly.
I mean, the Earth is sick. It's like your head is hurting. And if it hurts more, you have to do something.
I think we're pretty secure, but that doesn't mean everything's foolproof. I mean, you could never, you know, you should never say never. Well, you can't always guarantee things. You can easily fall out of that sustainable situation.
I wanted to know what they thought I should tell my mom. My mom thinks Tucson might become a ghost town soon, and she's not sure she should stay here. What do you think about that?
I used to think that way, and the more that I've learned about not only the water situation, but just the rest of the world, I wouldn't advise that. Where are you going to go? Where are you going to go?
Oh, it's so funny you're talking about Tucson becoming a ghost town, because I was just asked about that yesterday. Frankly, I don't see Tucson becoming a ghost town.
This idea that Tucson is going to dry up and blow away is just completely false. And I can tell you, if we ended up in a situation where that was going to happen, you would also be seeing the largest cities in the Western United States in the same, if not worse, situation. Phoenix, Las Vegas, Denver, Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco. If you saw something of that scale and magnitude happening in Tucson, you'd better believe that there is a real problem in our country and in our world. That's what I think.
I don't ever want to leave Tucson. And after talking to the experts, I know I don't have to. I don't worry so much about running out of water anymore, but I still worry about water. Maybe even more than ever. What I know now is that my water security comes at a price. Each drop of water that comes out of my tap is one less drop that exists in the river, and each drop comes with its own carbon footprint. The Colorado River Delta in Mexico was once the largest desert estuary in North America, but now it's just sad and dry. Animals that rely on its unique ecosystem are going extinct. And that makes me feel even worse than I did when I was only worrying about my city. But I also feel hopeful. We're using way less water than we used to, and we can keep getting better. Watershed Management Group has a plan to help the Santa Cruz River flow again in the next 50 years. And all I can think of is how sweet it would be to walk that block from my house and sit next to the flowing river, listening to birds and eating watermelon under the shade of the cottonwood trees. I'll be an old lady by then, but maybe one of my grandchildren will take me out for a boat ride. For City High Radio, I'm Paloma Martinez in Tucson.
This is Bird Note. Rachel Carson is best known for writing Silent Spring. The book sounded the alarm about DDT and other dangerous pesticides, and it's credited by many with sparking the modern environmental movement. But before that, Carson wrote books about the ocean, books that were both scientific and poetic. Silent Spring was a turning point in her writing, and Dorothy Freeman, Carson's most intimate friend, was worried that Carson would be persecuted. Professor Lita Maxwell, who studies Carson.
Keep doing your beautiful nature writing and don't go over there to the politics of it, essentially. But Carson has done years of research, and she's ready for the battle. And she writes Freeman a letter.
Knowing what I do, there would be no future peace for me if I kept silent. I wish I could feel that you want me to do it. I wish you could feel, as I do, that it is in the deepest sense a privilege, as well as a duty, to have the opportunity to speak out to many thousands of people on something so important.
And people listened, and they spoke out. DDT was eventually banned, and many birds made a comeback. Birds are resilient, and they can thrive, given a chance, and sometimes a champion. We have a longer version of this story. Check it out on our podcast, Bird Note Presents. Search for it in your podcast app, or find it at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
South Korea's Constitutional Court has rejected a petition seeking the repeal of a 2015 deal with Japan, settling a bitter dispute over Korean women enslaved for sex by the Japanese military during World War II. The ruling was in response to a petition by former sex slaves and their families, who say the agreement was made without their consent. The court ruled the deal was a non-binding political agreement that does not affect the victims' rights to seek official Japanese compensation. A decision to spike the deal could have complicated efforts to resolve separate ongoing trade and history disputes between the countries. A former top United Nations human rights official says the past decade has seen a backlash against human rights on every front, especially the rights of women and the LGBT communities. Andrew Gilmore left his position as UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights December 31st. In an exclusive interview with the Associated Press, Gilmore said the regression has not equaled the advances that began in the late 1970s, but he said it is still serious, widespread, and regrettable. He pointed to populist authoritarian nationalists on many continents, who he says are looking for scapegoats, usually from society's most vulnerable groups. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1590.